everybody, we start our deliberations with financial instruments with characteristics of equity. Daniel.
Thank you, Hans, and good morning, everyone. So in today's session, we've got a pack of five papers. Only three of those papers questions for the board. The first paper, agenda paper 5A, is simply just a reminder of what we've been discussing so far, and we've presented it for information only. But before we get into the details of agenda papers 5B, C, and D, I just wanted to give you an idea about how all this fits together. So in agenda paper 5A, we've set out just a brief summary of progress. Oh, and I forgot to mention, the FI team is expanding. We've got Uni, who's joined us as well, so it's her first board meeting. In agenda paper 5A, what I've done is I've just elevated a summary of the plan that we set out and how we progressed against that. So we've previously said that the way we're approaching this project is to identify the underlying rationale, the classification between liabilities and equity, explore separate presentation requirements and disclosure to supplement the classification approach, and to improve the consistency, completeness, and clarity of the requirements for classifying liabilities and equity. Now, we have in previous meetings set out three approaches to classification that would apply to obligations of the entity. We said that we are focusing on one of those approaches, the gamma approach, and that was because it contains a combination of features that are included in the other two approaches, and it's also closest to the existing classification outcomes of IAS 32. We have also considered separate presentation requirements that we have developed, and so these would be new requirements supplementing the existing requirements in 32 to help us address some of the challenges that we identified. We have always said that we cannot solve all the problems through classification alone. Therefore, we developed those separate presentation requirements to give us that additional tool that we can use to deal with some of the problems that we encounter, such as addressing the presentation of changes in obligations to pay cash that depend on the residual amount. We've also developed some requirements, which again are going to be new requirements, to provide information about different claims within equity. And so this was the attribution within equity, so to classes of equity other than ordinary shares. So with regards to what we set out to do, we have made progress on two points of the plan. Today we are considering how the gamma approach applies to the classification of derivatives on own equity. So this will, number one, it will help us to underpin the conceptual rationale that we've been developing for classification, because derivatives are complicated things and they test this kind of stuff. But it will also help us see how we might improve the consistency, completeness, and clarity of the requirements. Many of the existing challenges of 32 don't arise from the simple types of claims that we've been considering so far, but from derivatives on own equity. Derivatives are complicated things that bring together a number of different issues we've discussed in the past, and this, combined with the wide variety of them, really tests the existing requirements in 32, with many issues that have come before the Interpretations Committee remaining unresolved. So we're trying to address some of those as part of this. So the way that we approach the discussion and the analysis in the papers is, in agenda paper 5B, we provide an intro to derivatives, and we consider the unit of account. In agenda paper 5C, we consider classification of derivatives to exchange asset and equity underlines the classification of those types of contracts in their entirety. And in agenda 5D, we consider additional classification issues for obligations or derivatives to exchange liabilities and equity. The way we've generally undertaken the analysis is to first consider the consequences of a pure application of the gamma approach to derivatives, and then we compare the outcome to IS32 to see how far away the classification changes and how consistent it is to the existing classification outcomes. The focus of this session is on classification, but as we will mention later, the approach we suggest will provide some clarity and consistency regarding the classification of derivatives. So this will help us with the conceptual issues and some of the application issues. However, as I noted, we cannot expect to address all the challenges through classification alone. And so what we've done is we've identified some places where we think separate presentation requirements will come into effect and help us alleviate some of the challenges. We have not explored the separate presentation requirements in detail at this stage. We'd like to get agreement on the classification first before we get into that in a bit more detail. So following this discussion, and if the board agrees with the approach that or the direction we're taking, we'll address the separate presentation requirements at a future meeting as the immediate next step. In addition to presentation, so this is looking beyond this discussion, we have some other topics that we are planning to address following this meeting to complete the deliberations. These include disclosures. We have not yet discussed the disclosure package with you, and we've been waiting to finish up on the classification and presentation part before we bring that to you so we can see what bits we need to supplement. And we've scoped out of this discussion derivatives or options in particular where the issuer controls the exercise. And so at some future point, we're going to bring back a discussion about issuer-held options, and that includes where the issuer issues a claim that has settlement alternatives that meet liability and equity, because I think that brings into consideration the discussions we had at the ASAP on, for instance, economic compulsion. So before I move on to Agenda Paper 5B, does anyone have any comments or questions about the general progress status of the project?
Just a question, Manuel, in paragraph 26 of paper 5, where you intend in the future to investigate the interaction with IFRS 9 for classification of derivatives at Fairview P&L. Reading that paragraph, I was asking myself whether the derivatives on equity that we are discussing now are really of the same nature as those derivatives which are dealt with in IFRS 9, or are not we trying to find interactions which may not in practice exist? Or to investigate investigations.
I think most of the time,
to me, there are different kinds of things, right?
Yeah, I think in that paragraph, what we're really referring to is the embeds. And so it's not just the standalone derivatives that might be liability classified, which probably presents less challenges, but it's whatever we come up with in terms of separate presentation and the population that we want to present separately, how that interacts with the embedded derivatives. And again, there might be some interaction following this discussion, because when we talk about, for instance, some of the types of derivatives that might be classified as liabilities, so derivatives on an equity that might be classified as liabilities, we plan to think again a little bit about the separate presentation requirements, so we're sure that it all kind of ties in together in a neat package.
When an instrument has an equity leg, it's an hybrid, we typically separate the two items and we don't consider that as being an embedded derivative. So I was not sure about how this compounded or hybrid instruments separation would play with this question of the derivatives here.
Well, that's what we need to, I guess, look at when we bring some of the separate presentation requirements back, because it's how the once we decide that, for instance, a claim as a whole is a liability, but it still contains some kind of equity characteristic, how we go about separating that, because at the moment we for instance, the dual index stuff is separated as a whole, whether we want to carry that forward, whether we want to apply the separate presentation requirements to that. So I think there's a few things in there that we might want to explore in a future discussion. But all we're saying there is the discussion paper might just explore some of those issues.
There we go.
Manuel, now you sometimes use the word presentation, you know, and sometimes use attribution and disclosure. May I suggest, you know, whether it will be useful and helpful to, you know, have a skeleton as soon as possible to board members? You know, the reason are two. Firstly, I like the ideas Hans Wens raised last month or Wednesday, 2 months ago. You know, we want to see, you know, broad directions. You know, I also feel it is quite useful for us. And secondly, since we put this project into a broad bucket called communication in our new agenda, and I will feel it will be more useful, you know, for us to understand broadly, you know, the relationship, the proposals, what are those beyond to the presentation aspect, what are those beyond to attribution, or maybe relate to EPS, or what are those which may broadly related to disclosure. As I understand, you know, sometimes it's hard to distinguish it among these three aspects. I don't want to see a very precise, comprehensive, but at least as soon as possible, give us a broad picture would be very useful.
So in terms of, okay, for instance, with the equity instruments, the attribution, I single that out because we'd be introducing some requirements that would actually calculate the amount that would be recognized within equity, whereas I think for the liability stuff, I don't think we plan on changing any of the recognition and measurement requirements. So that would be a pure presentation. So just breaking that out in a bit more detail, Wegwe.
I think what you're asking for, Wegwe, as we develop, how do we distinguish between attribution and presentation? You would like to get an idea of what's going to go where and what the picture. I think we will do that. Obviously, that's a good suggestion.
Raw pictures rather than precise and comprehensive.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's when we come to presentation and other things, we will keep the things together.
Okay. Should we move on to agenda paper 5B?
Please.
Yeah, okay. So agenda paper 5B first gives an overview of derivatives on own equity and the gamma approach. So in that analysis, we're simply noting that derivatives are, you know, can be analogized to exchange contracts. There are three different types of exchanges, potential exchanges that we identify that are relevant to the discussion. They include the exchange of the receipt of an asset in exchange for delivering equity. And there's two types of liability equity exchanges, one where liability is received, redeemed, extinguished in exchange for issuing equity, and the other is redeeming, extinguishing equity in exchange for delivering a liability. We also note that exercise can be conditional, but we say that we focus on contracts that are unconditional, so like forward contracts, and contracts that are conditional on the counterparty's options. So these are the written options. We also note that the gamma approach, as we've developed it so far, tells us only if one of the underlying obligations of that exchange contract or one of the underlying legs of the exchange contract has the features of liability or equity. But it doesn't yet tell us whether the contract as a whole should be classified as equity, liability, or asset. However, before we consider how gamma could apply to classification of contracts as a whole, we first devote just a little bit of time to think about whether there's any other way to approach this. The contract as a whole unit of account is the existing unit of account in IAS 32, so we just analyze whether there's some other options. So in paragraphs 31 to 41 of Agenda Paper 5B, we consider the unit of account, in particular whether the contracts can be split into the constituent legs and whether that might help address some of the challenges. We also briefly consider whether we can save ourselves from all this trouble by simply classifying all derivatives as assets or liabilities. In the analysis, in summary, we conclude that in our view the board should not split derivatives further. We think that splitting derivatives further raises additional conceptual and operational challenges that may not be so easily overcome. We also note that the existing unit of account for derivatives is consistent across all of our financial instrument literature, including IFRS 9. So in our view, we think the unit of account should stay the entire contract. We also don't think that all derivatives should either be classified as, should be classified as either assets or liabilities. So we should not prohibit equity classification for derivatives. We think that classification of some derivatives as equity would help achieve the objectives of the gamma approach. Again, this is going back to what information we want to be delivering through the classification and presentation requirements to users of financial statements. I mean, we would have to provide that information one way or another. If it's not through the classification, then we'd have to develop even more requirements for separate presentation to deliver that information. So we don't think that that's a valid approach. Does anyone have any questions before we ask the board whether you agree?
So you don't want my answer? Not so much a question as a sort of observation or thought. I think what's going to be important for the discussion paper is having a good articulation of our sort of idea that's the foundation for everything that we then develop. And if I look at the articulation of the gamma approach that's in paragraph 14 of 5b, and in particular little b, where we talk about what the amount of the obligation is and why that's relevant, and that it's relevant for assessing the extent to which you've got sufficient resources to satisfy claims and sufficient returns to satisfy claims. And if I look particularly at some of these derivatives where there's some link to equity but not a pure link to equity, other things get mixed into it. I wonder whether what we're really trying to capture is something slightly more subtle in this amount leg, in addition to what you've got here, where in a sense the return is not perfectly aligned with that of an ordinary shareholder, so it's giving a sort of leveraged effect in terms of the outcome on the ordinary shareholders. I think that's also what's behind this amount thing. And even though that sounds like a bit of a geek's point, I think it might be important, because if I'm a bank looking at our discussion paper, and I've got a huge balance sheet and I just issue a smallish tranche of derivatives, you're never going to convince me that there's really going to be a risk of me not having sufficient economic resources or whatever to satisfy the claim. So you're not going to sell me on your argument for that. But if you talk about changing the sort of profile of an ordinary shareholder because of the attributes, then I think it's consistent with what Gamma's getting at, and it's a more convincing logic to underpin the whole analysis.
I think just on the, on these points, what we're talking about this is more in, I guess, in aggregate. So I mean, individual liabilities aren't going to, you know, bankrupt the entity, but it's the aggregate effect.
I don't think you need to argue with me, because I think it's
no, I'm
I
not.
Think it's
yeah,
consistent
I think, I'm
with
agreeing
the logic.
With you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm agreeing.
So
with you.
They're not going to stop at that argument. But I think we are capturing another more subtle thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're missing that in our argument at the moment.
I think it also could be important when we start looking at deal index things and what element of the return. I think that is where it becomes, the subtlety
will
becomes clear.
Tie all of your recommendations together.
Yep. Tuck?
Thank you. Actually, the first question in the agenda paper 5B is closely related to other papers. So once we decide we should not bifurcate, then it would affect the questions to the 5B and 5C.
Yeah.
So therefore, I think, in a sense, from the viewpoint of staff, it's a good approach, because we have already decided we are not going to bifurcate. So then automatically answer is like this. However, this question is very important.
Yes.
And idealistically speaking, there are two types of variability on the asset or liability leg. So one is related to equity price. The other has nothing to do with equity price. So idealistically, we should bifurcate the variability, which has nothing to do with equity price. Say the typical example is foreign exchange rate change. So the original idea of financial instrument is purely fixed for fixed. However, because it's denominated in foreign currency, so then there is a variability. Then that variability affects the judgment of liability equity judgment. So maybe it is not. So in that case, we should bifurcate. That is the idealistic situation. Having said that, in the case of foreign exchange, it's easy. However, there are many other difficult derivatives which you cannot really bifurcate. So basically, we should follow the idea of IFRS 9 and the basic idea of our IFRS standard. So we have to judge the transaction as a whole. So we do not really do not make any specific rule of this FICE project. So that is the concept of 5B. Is my understanding correct? However, probably the provision, I mean, the some kind of the basis for this judgment is coming from the future separate presentation. Maybe in the future we are going to make a separate presentation. So therefore, based on the understanding that we are going to consider separate presentation, for now, can we decide that we are not going to bifurcate? If that is your logic, I totally agree with your proposal.
We're going to consider separate presentation, but you know, again, that doesn't mean that for the separate presentation requirements we're going to componentize the contract. We might just disaggregate.
Yeah, I'm not saying that.
I think I absolutely agree that that is the essence of what we are talking about. Let me just clarify one point. Sorry, what we are talking about is componentizing a derivative, because I'm careful about that, because we do bifurcate embedded derivatives and we are not planning to change any of that.
Yeah, I understand.
What we are saying is, to be consistent with 9, 32 and our entire literature on this, we don't go any further and start splitting derivatives out. Fully appreciate that it doesn't solve some of the other problems that we come up, and that's why, as Manuel said, the package that we are looking at is, this is classification, and we will come to presentation and see how we can address some of those concerns through the presentation requirements. But we are not saying, most probably we will not also propose componentizing derivatives when we are looking at presentation as well. It will be the whole derivative, and we'll look at changes from that.
Gary?
Thank you. And I'll start off with just a simple clarifying question, then I'll probably ask you a follow-on question that shows my general ignorance on some of this stuff. But on page 11, for the top, it'd be 42B, first line, it says the board should not classify all derivatives. I think you mean the board should not classify any derivatives on its own equity, correct?
Yes.
And by the way, in general, I agree with not going further with detailed componentization. In general, like, not a fan of bifurcation. So that's in subject to what might come up in other papers. On board with not going further on componentization. But when you say we're not going to classify derivatives on equity as liabilities, but one thing that would help me in a lot of these papers.
Sorry, can I clarify, Gary? What we're proposing classifies so derivatives that have an underlying which is equity. If we're classifying the contract as a whole, some of those will be classified as equity and some of them will be classified as liabilities or assets. What I'm saying in 42B is that we're rejecting classifying all derivatives on own equity as assets or liabilities. There's still going to be some under the approaches that we consider that would
that's
be
classified. That's not evidence, you know, as the paper is articulated.
Yeah.
That's what it's about.
You know, one thing that would help me in this and future papers really to see the debits and credits of the T accounts. Because when you say if you have classify a derivative is equity, I mean, there's going to be a debit and credit, there's going to be a payable receivable, and two, would there not be? I mean, how would you book it? If you have a derivative as an equity,
yeah.
What let's say, just give me a simple debit and credit.
Okay, so for instance, if you issue a warrant,
mm-hmm.
you'd receive cash for the premium of the option, and you'd credit equity for the warrant. And so if the warrant is exercised, you'd get an additional amount of
that
cash.
I understand. Okay.
And issue equity.
The derivatives that you would mark to market, you know.
Well,
if the debit or credit's got to be in the back end.
Yeah, so for instance, if that was simply liability classified, you'd still recognize the cash and you'd credit the liability. And if you're marking to market, then debit credit expense, gain or loss, and debit credit the value of the liability. So I think that's
okay, understand.
Quite as simple.
I say the question was probably illustrating more of my lack of knowledge. But again, T accounts and an appendix would actually be helpful in a lot of these.
Chang Wu?
Thank you. Following Tuck's comments, and based on the comments on Steve's yesterday on performance, maybe measuring some kind of performance. So I'm just suggesting maybe I agree with the analysis on this kind of component deviation might be very difficult to separate the interdependence and the operational complexity. And as you said, SSI does not separate the derivatives in more details. So everything is a quite good conclusion. But as Tuck suggested and Steve said, if foreign currency change is the change in value of foreign currency, the rate is huge, but that was classified as in equity. So if we do not separate that effect, even though separate presentation does not help to make a good performance measure. So based on the beginning of this project, you are saying we need to make a good performance information and good position information. However, because of this, because all kind of difficulties, we are giving up that kind of recognition of interest and expense if that instrument, that derivative are classified as equity. So what I'm saying is it still better way? Is there any better way to make performance measures be more useful in this area?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think whichever way you look at, I mean, derivatives are complicated and they combine a lot of different characteristics, and whichever way we try to address some of these issues, there's always some challenge that pops up that we need to kind of think about and address. And it comes back to this binary distinction that we have. It's not going to solve all our problems, so whichever way we approach it, we're going to have to require some additional requirements. The objective is still the same, and we still think we can achieve the objective of giving users the information that is useful. It just might be a bit more challenging in terms of how the different parts of classification and presentation might interact. And we're also going to think about disclosure so that we make sure that we faithfully represent whatever we end up classifying as liabilities or equity.
Amaru?
Thanks, Hans. Somewhat coming back to Takas and Shan Hu, but to get there, I have to before express my views in general on the set of papers, because I think it's appropriate to build up my sense. First, I think we have to commend staff to really bring back to us what we asked them to do. So we asked them not to review or rebuild IS-32. My sense is that IS-32 is not broken. IS-32 has some particular challenges, and these challenges can be portrayed in this series of papers on derivatives and on equity. So I think first, with that mandate, the staff really brought back to us something that really aims to the challenges in IS-32 today. So keeping IS-32 main, I would say, principles. Second is that the no componentization to me is very important because of its consistency with IFRS 9. If we decide to componentize, we will actually be open up the door and questions about why we didn't do that in other very important statements, standards. So but to me it's absolutely key that we do not componentize. So these two aspects are very important. But then, and I think staff in paper 5 indicates in the next steps, 5A, that at some point we'll need to discuss presentation, the form of disclosure, how to inform users about this particular characteristics of these complex instruments that sometimes that is not really possible to capture all aspects only in that classification and measurement itself. So I think we are in the right direction here. I totally agree with what the staff is proposing. I would say, yes, foreign exchange is an issue to be more informed, but I wouldn't seek to capture this in componentizing the instruments. Yes, performance is something important, but there is another aspect that we didn't even mention, no one mentioned up to now, is dilution is still important, and how to capture this presentation, disclosure at some point. Well, the project as it is, I think, at this stage, if the board approved these sets of papers, I am really optimistic that we are reaching a point where we can see ahead of us a good discussion paper, a good state for going out and debate these aspects with stakeholders and particularly with users. Presentation will be key in this project. But we have to be very careful in keeping it consistent with other standards that we have already.
Kumar?
Thanks, Amaro. Appreciate it. Just what I wanted to make the point, yes, acutely aware of the foreign currency issue. I come from a jurisdiction where this is important. But also, what we are trying to do is get consistency on the classification side so that the application of Gamma, so that we know what is the principles, what are the principles driving it. And then we look at presentation to see if that, as a total package, gives us a solution. Because as Amara also pointed out, the challenge is not just the classification, but also the performance, as Changu mentioned, which gets warped quite a bit when these drivers affect the P&L. So we will come to that. We will certainly explore that. We are aware of it. But what we are trying to do here as a first step is to have a consistent classification basis using Gamma so that we at least know also from that what are the movements that are going to come into P&L so that we can look at it and see how we can address the challenges going forward.
I think we're not playing by the rules of the game that the staff have set out for us, because the first paper they're trying not to get into what's in the different categories. They're really asking, I think, the basic question of, do you agree not to split derivatives into pieces?
Yeah.
And do you agree that some will be equity and some won't be equity?
Yes.
That's all you really wanted us to talk about, but we're naughty.
Don't play by the rules. I thought you were going to talk about that.
So I'll talk about your question. Am I allowed to answer the question now? Yeah. So I agree with the staff's recommendation that we don't componentize derivatives, partly because we don't do it anywhere else in our literature, so it would be a new thing to do. And I think the reason why we don't do it in our literature at the moment is that I think it would be complex for people. They don't think about derivatives and pieces, they think about them as single things. I also think it quickly becomes a very artificial exercise, trying to find components in a single derivative contract. And I think there's a lot of interrelationships. So I think people think on the surface that it's easy to strip out the FX bit. I don't know that that's actually true at all. Also, I think we get into very artificial measurement, because if you were to directly measure each of the pieces, they're probably not going to add to the whole, and we're probably not going to want gains or losses, and so something's going to have to be the fudge factor. So I think it's going to be complicated and it's going to be imprecise. It's going to be an artificial exercise, so I agree with not doing that. I also strongly agree that that there should be some derivatives, at least on own equity, that get an equity label. Then we can have a debate about which ones get that label, which I'll come back to, but I certainly agree with your questions in 5B.
Martin.
Yeah, I also tend to agree to these questions, but
It is difficult to finally decide on that before we have the solution on presentation, because man, that is really the problem. Because man, we started this project because we have identified some issues, and now we are developing this gamma approach, and we go step by step by step. But at least it is difficult to see, okay, do we have a solution then for the problems we have identified? For example, if I would agree to that, but then in presentation you would then propose that maybe this equity or the derivatives with an equity component, which then classified as liability, and you would then liability should be then measured through P&L, and then the equity piece is a big piece, I would not agree to that. And maybe then
I think I'm
there's a different solution here. So I agree, yes, but under the condition to really find a solution with presentation and classification. Yeah. That is for me the...
Yeah, and we've already brought in some of this. We've already discussed some of the presentation. That was the point of having that discussion before. So you have
was
some
also not so happy with some of
the. So you have some idea, and we're going to revisit that. In particular, we'll eventually bring back the P&L versus OCI point as well.
But as I said, in general, I think that's
right. As I said, Martin, it's a package. We will bring back, and we will ask for another view.
Yeah.
And let me, I'll start by echoing some of what Amaro was saying in terms of congratulating the staff for taking us back and building blocks to get us to consistent thinking about these issues without throwing IS-32 out the window, which is the very difficult act that we gave you. And I think it's maybe illustrated more in the next paper that we'll talk about. What I found very useful is we can see where we have alignment or don't have alignment with current outcomes under 32, but more importantly, we see principles that you have distilled that become underpinnings for a lot of the conclusions we had in 32, but that now kind of sit independently, and it pulls them together as a package. So I can see the shape of something that will accomplish what we set out to do, which is by underpinning, you used the word reinforcing that I think is very good, by underpinning 32 with more articulated principles, we give it the resilience to answer questions that as new products come out. So I think congratulations, on that for managing the process so that we didn't, let this become a mushroom. And in terms of the questions you ask in paper 5B, I agree with the staff recommendation that it's good we considered, and I agree with the proposal to reject an approach of componentizing derivatives. I think one thing that will make me maybe not so popular for you is to say, given the level of concern around FX, I think we probably have to come back and look at that issue isolated to FX, whether there's anything special we should or should not do about it, just because it is something that so many different people keep raising as a concern. But I think it should be against the background of the conclusion that you have recommended here, which is basic conclusion, we do not componentize. And that gives us a very different starting point for looking at the question of does FX create any special problems, as opposed to having FX drive us to a componentization approach more generally.
Yep. Okay, should we ask the question? So the questions are on page 12 of agenda paper 5B. So the first question is whether you agree with us that full componentization, so breaking up the legs of the derivative, should not be explored further, and so derivatives should be classified in their entirety. Yep.
All in favor.
Just 11, by the way.
And the second question there is whether you agree with us that to not require all derivatives on an equity to be classified as assets or liabilities. So that will permit some, or that we'll discuss later, derivatives to be classified as equity.
All in favor.
Okay. So moving on to agenda paper 5C. This paper discusses the application of the gamma approach to standalone exchanges that will result in the entity receiving an asset in exchange for delivering equity. So it's looking at the application, importantly, of the gamma approach to these contracts as a whole. So when looking at how gamma might apply to these, the combined contracts, what we basically say is that we look at whether the contract as a whole requires the entity to transfer resources other than at liquidation, and whether the contract as a whole promises an amount that is independent of the entity's economic resources. So if it has either of those two features, then it's a liability. If it has none of those features, then it is equity. So in paragraphs 12 to 30, we apply this approach to the classification of relatively simple contracts, and we just demonstrate that, you know, contracts that are either physically settled or net share settled, and also where the value of the contract in its entirety is solely determined by the value of the entity's ordinary shares, are equity under gamma. So examples of these contracts are typical types of warrants that are issued that exchange a fixed number of the entity's shares in exchange for receiving a fixed amount of the entity's functional currency. We also give some examples of derivatives that we can fairly easily conclude that are liabilities. So that includes all derivatives that are net cash settled, regardless of what the amount is. Also contracts that are entirely independent of the entity's economic resources. So these would be typical types of derivatives that could be indexed to FX, commodities, or some other variable. And again, that would be regardless of the settlement. These contracts would be entirely independent of the entity's resources. So we also note that these are similar to IS 32 classification outcomes. The only difference is the net share settled contract to receive a fixed amount of cash in exchange for issuing a fixed number of shares that is net share settled, which would be a liability under IS 32. We then devote some time in the paper to analyzing contracts that pose some more challenges for the gamma approach. And so what we call these are variable for fixed contracts. So these are contracts to receive a variable amount of cash or some other asset in exchange for issuing equity. So for example, the entity delivers a fixed number of shares in exchange for receiving an amount that is indexed to, it could be FX, it could be commodity indexes, it could be some other equity index. Now what this means for this type of contract is that in its entirety, it is neither entirely independent of the entity's economic resources, nor is it solely dependent on the residual amount. So the fact that it's indexed to both something other than a fixed amount of the entity's functional currency, and it also depends on, for instance, the entity's ordinary share price, raises some challenges that we need to think about under the gamma approach. We do consider some of the advantages and disadvantages of both liability and equity classification of these types of contracts. We also note that IS 32 classifies some of these as liabilities and some of these as equity, depending on whether the foreign currency rights issue exception is met. We considered also whether there is some broad principle that we could identify that allows some level of appropriate variability in the asset leg to be classified as equity. However, we couldn't really identify a principle for including some types of variability and not including others. So in the end, in our view, the objectives of the gamma approach would be better achieved if these were liability classified. In that way, we'd have a very clear classification principle for equity and non-equity, and we'd seek to address some of the challenges of including that equity leg within liability as through separate presentation. So we came to this because we think including the variability resulting from some index within equity, if it was equity classified, might be difficult to depict using the approaches to separate presentation that we've developed before with four items classified as equity. It's also the degree of prominence that we could give to these changes within equity would be impaired. The fact that the equity exposure is also included in these contracts is not unique if we classify them as liabilities. We've already talked about separate presentation requirements for instance, contracts that are settled in cash but are linked to the entity's share price. However, we think that this is an area, again, that we'll want to revisit at a future meeting to make sure that everything ties in a nice, neat package. It would also be mostly consistent with the current requirements of IAS 32, excluding the impact of the FX rights issue exception. So we acknowledge that it would be inconsistent with the rights issue exception, but we think that classifying everything consistently and addressing the contracts, all these different types of contracts that have these features, consistently through separate presentation as well, might be a better way of providing useful information to users and meeting the objectives of the gamma approach. So I'll turn it over to the board before we go to the question.
Sue?
I agree with your analysis and I agree with where you've landed. But I agree with that because I think of the gamma approach with this sort of leverage effect on ordinary shareholders that I was talking about in the first paper. So I think to support why you think that's a good reflection of performance, yep. I think you need to tie that back in there. Because you are, in response to some people's earlier comments about performance, we haven't lost sight of performance, but we think because the returns on these derivatives aren't perfectly aligned with those of ordinary shareholders, that because of that variability, it's relevant to performance to include that within P&L, in effect, is sort of implicit in what we're assuming. But we need to take people along on that journey to have a chance of convincing them of that. I agree that at a minimum, we'd need to look at presentation approaches to try and help some of the instruments where people are going to think it's not necessarily the way they would want to depict their view of the world. But sort of building on scarily something that Mary said on the last paper, particularly because we're removing this would result in removing some of the exceptions we've created in the past, such as the rights issue exception, and because we already know that people object to the outcome for foreign currency convertible contracts, I think that we need to at least give some airtime in the discussion paper to maybe a different approach, which would be to draw the line. I don't think we should, in terms of what my preferred outcome would be, but I think in terms of presenting it to give a good discussion and to give people an ability to feel heard and to enter into the debate. I wonder whether there is a way of thinking about a sort of additional perspective to think of over and above the gamma approach, which would be thinking about whether or not we think the foreign currency aspects are sort of a natural part of the instrument or not. What do I mean by that? I think that people might differentiate between a situation where I just, you know, negotiate bilaterally with Martin and enter into a foreign currency denominated convertible derivative just because I feel like it. That sort of feels like something that I don't have necessarily a lot of sympathy for. But if I want to issue funding using a foreign currency denominated convertible, and the only foreign currency convertible market I can access is a US dollar denominated market, and my functional currency is not US dollars, I didn't set out to really take on a foreign currency type contract. I was just funding myself in the only market that was available. I wonder whether we need to be thinking about some sort of, and I don't mean closely related as it's articulated in IAS 39, but that sort of concept of, is there a class of instruments where, because of the context, we can be kinder on classification and allow some of those into equity classification because of their context, where, and that's more important than having the simplicity of a streamlined model. Now, I, on balance, don't think that's a good thing because I think it's going to add to complexity. I think, you know, I don't like the embedded criteria we have in 39 now. It's complex, it's rule-based, all of those things. But I think there's going to be a whole community of people out there who are going to think that we're just unconnected with reality unless And if I say to them, but you can present it separately, they're going to say, and doesn't do it for me. So I think we need to at least have given some airtime and given our views for why, if as a board we don't think that's the way to go, we've still got back to this, which would be my position, but I think we need to at least have articulated it to have a better debate with people.
Yep.
Jungu?
Thank you. May I ask on the paragraph 23? However, IAS 32, based on IAS 32, is net share settlement derivatives is what? This is not an equity, it's a liability, right?
Yep.
Gamma approach, you are suggesting that net share settlement is a equity. So this is a big difference between this gamma approach and IAS 32 classification. And I'm suggesting, you know, the analysis is very good, you know, your excellent paper, excellent analysis, everything is perfect. But I'm saying
but,
that,
but.
Excellent, everything is excellent. Yeah, everything is excellent. However, is it any two comments? One is, what is the rationale why the net share settlement is classified as a liability? Why we is it the fixed condition requiring a kind of gross settlement, fiscal settlement? Why? Do you know why? The rationale?
That's a good question.
Huh?
Why
the gross settlement only can be classified as equity? So that's what I'm saying to ask you.
It's a good question. I'm not.
Nobody knows.
I'm not sure.
So what I'm suggesting is, you know, based on the paper, there 5D, you are suggesting us to accommodate many concepts in addition to gamma approach, right? Convertible bond accounting, and the redemption obligation requirement, and fixed condition, accommodating everything. These are sometimes are not related to classification. Sometimes maybe redemption, instrument requirement, right. It looks like a measurement rather than to classification. So these kind of things, under the gamma approach, we need to accommodate some existing concepts to classify, or there's some debt and equity, or present some kind of a income and expenses. Such kind of everything. So what I'm suggesting is we need to investigate why net or gross settlement might affect the classification of debt and equity. If you can find any good rationale, then this idea can be also accommodated under the gamma approach. Then in that case, gamma approach classification and IAS 32 classification is the same. So this is a kind of one piece of the classification that is different from the IAS 32 on the gamma protection system.
I agree, Chung. I think, you know, we could do a bit more research or go back to 32. I'm not sure. I've done a bit, and I wasn't able to find much to support why the conclusion. But then again, you know, the IAS 32 starting point is simply, you know, physically settled, fixed for fixed, and then everything kind of follows. But again, you know, the reason why we're sort of in the position we're in is that we're developing some kind of underlying rationale for gamma as to why this might be the case, and that simply doesn't exist in 32, I think. So we can do some research. I don't think that's going to be very productive. But what I think might be better would be to simply in the discussion paper, explain what the application of the gamma approach, what the outcomes would be, you know, show the comparison with IAS 32, receive comments on that, see whether, you know, number one, whether it would be worth changing IAS 32 for this point. It might not simply be worth changing it. But it might, on the other hand, be well supported for the reasons that we kind of explain, and based on what we're trying to achieve with the gamma approach. So I think that might be better to get some input on that point.
Martin?
Yeah, I also agree with the conclusions of this paper, but I still have a question, because I agree with this fixed cash for fixed shares, okay, that we have this different treatments or in Appendix A, but I always struggle with if we have this net share settlement or physical share settlement, and then companies really using treasury shares for to fulfill this kind of obligation. That is my biggest problem with this kind of general distinction between how you end up in liability and equity, because I have seen in the market is okay that banks and others using this kind of net share settlement or physical settlement, but really don't using then by issuing new shares. They buying shares on the market, their own shares, and then fulfilling that. That means they have to provide cash to buying really these treasury shares. And that is a way how it is dealt. And then it is a kind of, how would I say that, it is form over substance. Because if you have cash settlement, or if you have then buy treasury shares with cash is in substance the same, but the form is different in the agreement. Oh. And the practice is that is what my problem is. Okay, we looking at features which is then, I totally understand it, it is a kind of form of this kind of contracts, but in substance it is not any different. Because it is quite often fulfilled with buying treasury shares, and that's the reason why they have to do it.
To
some, not this obligation, I understand that. Yeah. It's not this obligation element, because, but.
I think that's why, that's one of the benefits, I think, of not solely looking at settlement and also looking at the amount of the obligation, so we capture some of these features, because it's not, you know, whether in sort of typical circumstances where the entity can freely kind of, there's a liquid market in its equity instruments, then the liquidity question sort of falls away. But what remains is, you know, how the returns are distributed amongst the different claim holders, and so we're capturing that. I think what we've said, however, is that liquidity issues do matter, and to the extent that it does have an obligation to pay cash, then it has that obligation. And what we're saying here is, for the physically settled and the net share settled, they don't have that obligation. So I agree with you, and we're going to capture some of the effects of the how the value of the claim changes, and that's going to be captured. But we also said at the outset, and we're applying the gamma approach, that whether the claim obliges the entity to pay cash is another key feature that we're interested in. And that's, there's a difference between being obligated to buy back your own shares versus entering into some transaction in the future to just repurchase your shares on the market. And that's one of the things we want to capture.
Because unless they actually had the legal ability to issue their own shares to settle the derivative, they wouldn't be able to get equity classification anyway, right?
That's right.
So it's completely within their control whether they choose to buy back their shares.
That's right, That's the idea.
Mary?
I am okay with the fact that having gone through the exercise of developing Gamma, looking at its approach, that we end up with a difference from IS 32, including the foreign currency rights exception. So, it's possible that when we started on this journey that we would have developed a principle that would have ended up with the foreign currency rights being equity classified on the basis of principle, but we didn't. And having developed principles that seem to be working that end up with that difference, I think we identified as that difference, and as Sue said, let's look at exploring whether FX is special in any way as a separate thing. So I think that's fine as long as we report it, because again, we get a principle to kind of underlie. Chung Wu was saying to you, can you find out more of the reasoning that was behind 32? And I think what we're doing is, in effect, building the reasoning. it might be helpful to his point, to Chung-Lu's point, to see if there are any other arguments or thinking that was behind 32 that we should consider in development of gamma as a, you know, as a stress test of gamma. But I am not oriented to trying to accommodate certain things within the gamma approach, but I do want to make sure we've thought through all, you know, all the things that people might have considered in the past, because going back to earlier statements, we tend to think of 32 as working pretty well for what it's dealing with now. It's the, you know, it's equipping it to deal with things in the future that, you know, that are emerging now in the future that is our objective. Now, one thing that you seem to be concerned about in the paper is the notion that because we're classifying the contract as a whole, there will be, if we classify the contract as a whole as liability, then there will be some true equity movement that ends up getting remeasured as a change in liability. And if we, you know, and when you're talking about that as a concern with gamma, and to me, I'm not concerned about it, because when we look back at the expression of gamma in paragraph 5 and 6, and that's kind of, you know, what's the liability and what's equity, gamma is not a, as soon as you have something that's a little bit, your liability, you know, in order to be equity under gamma, you cannot be required to have any transfer of economic resources before liquidation, and has to be for an amount that depends entirely on the residual amount and not tied to something. So I think a consequence of an approach that says to be this, you have to be clean, is that as soon as you start to get a little movement, you know, a little variation from that, you're outside of equity, and I think the consequence of the decision that we took in the previous paper not to componentize means if you've got it all in equity, you could look at the total change in value and try and decompose it to, let me isolate the piece that is, you know, true equity movement and then the rest, but we've already decided not to componentize. So, you know, if we say you got to be this to be equity, if you have a little bit that's not that, you're out. And then, yes, there's some noise in the movement that you could attribute to the changes in equity, but we've decided not to componentize. So that's it. All of that together is part of the change in the liability. Now, we can look at whether we, you know, we do any kind of special presentation. That, you know, that's what we're going to talk about later. But I think we have to knit together all the consequences of these decisions. And it doesn't distress me that we come out to some different places if we can explain why. And I think you've done it. So supportive of the, you know, the arguments and the logic. I think we don't need to tromp over, oh, there may be a problem because the consequence of this is some mixed movement being all recorded as a change in liability. I think that's just a consequence of not componentizing.
Yes, I think Mary is making a very good point. I would add to it, how does the concept of materiality play in relation to that issue? Because if I have this item which is not fully clean, but has a small bit which is dirty, but is not material on day one, given the consequences of that classification, which could be very material, how do you assess how unclean is that little bit in terms of materiality? How do you deal? I think it's important that we think.
Sparkling
white. Yeah, I mean, so I think there is an issue here about how material as this unclean item to be to trigger classification, which then has very material consequences. Now, I wanted to go back to Gary's point on the debits and credits. When I look at tables 1 and 2, your first two examples, where you conclude it's equity, then no debits on credit, no debits on credits, I suppose. But then I ask myself, so and then what do we do? And then I read your little footnote one on page 5, which tells me the answer. But I think it would be clearer if we were to draw the consequences of this conclusion here and say, and then what do we do? And what information can we provide? Because if it is equity in entirety, you don't do debits on credits. But if the example two has any substance, I suppose it is an exchange from classes A to class B shares. It cannot be class A against class A shares. It has to be two different classes of equity. Otherwise, there is no substance to such a net settled forward. You would not exchange like for like in a net settled thing unless I don't see a substance for that. It's probably
quite common, Philippe, I think, if net settled in ordinary shares.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, but net settled of what? I mean, there is an exchange, a forward here, for receiving a variable number of shares in exchange for delivery of fixed numbers of then ordinary shares. And your spelling says shares versus ordinary shares. It is not ordinary against ordinary, I suppose. Otherwise, I would not see the substance of a net settled transaction dealing only with ordinary shares. I suppose there are. And then the question is the split within equity and the attribution of those various things, which I think you allude to, amount would be attributed to these contracts within equity, which is your footnote one. It gives me a little bit of the answer. What do I do with this kind of contract? I think it would be clearer, and as Gary said, to show the debits and credits, if any, and absent any debits and credits, to show what information is useful then to illustrate the effects of such transactions on the various classes of equity.
Yeah. So we could, I didn't illustrate the, we did think about, I think, two or three different ways that we might do the attribution within equity. And I suppose we could have illustrated one of those approaches just to give you an idea for how that might play out.
The footnote is important and people may overlook that very important footnote when you don't have any debits and credits to record the effect of the transaction. Then you need to do something else.
Yeah. Okay. So the question is, on page 14, below paragraph 57, the first question is, do you agree with our analysis of the application of the gamma approach to asset equity exchange derivatives? And I suppose we can ask the second question as well at the same time, which would include that variable for fixed derivatives should be classified as liabilities applying the gamma approach.
All in favor.
Excellent.
Yeah, the more complex it becomes, the more in agreement we are.
How come? Because we, I'll understand it perfectly or not.
I'll take it
as a compliment.
At some point.
Probably what you should do.
Agenda.
Could I just ask one question? So we've decided that variable fixed classified as liabilities. That's fine, I agree. Classification.
However.
And I agree no componentization for the purpose of that classification. But when are we going to discuss the presentation? Is it possible that you're thinking of componentization for presentation purposes, even though it's not classification, or is it the whole of the gain or loss has to be presented in a particular way? I know I'm peeking ahead.
Yeah, I think we'd probably have to consider a couple of different ways that we might want to do the presentation. Some of that would be looking at the entire gain or loss. We could also, for instance, think about some disaggregation, which isn't completely the same as componentization, but doing some type of disaggregation might be possible within liabilities, because then we're just looking at breaking up the movement into separate bits, so that might be possible as well. But I don't think we'd go down a componentization approach for the same reasons that we outlined for why componentization doesn't work for classification. If we do, by any chance, look at a way to do it, and we find a way to do the componentization, then it would be very difficult to argue why we're not doing it for classification purposes.
No. Vice versa. I'm not sure how you'd come up with a disaggregation approach that's going to be doable if we concluded that it was too complicated to buy.
Yeah, but I think we can have a look at a separate presentation and see what we can do. We might, for instance, do something that's a bit more rough for presentation than it would be for classification.
What's the difference between componentization and disaggregation?
The difference is
one is proper English and the other.
But let's not go into future papers too much.
Yeah, I don't want to preempt that.
Okay.
That
let's analysis, not preempt.
But I guess.
Oh, wait, sorry.
Yeah, but on the componentization point, I think pulling out a piece and classifying it, it's sort of the bifurcation kind of effect.
It's real.
Sorry?
It's real as opposed to artificial. You're thinking you can be fudgier if it's disaggregation, right? Whereas bifurcation is.
Well, let's not peek ahead to.
let's discuss next paper. September.
I'm not completely, but yeah, let's let's leave that for the next session. See if we can come up with.
And please make another effort to see whether you can find a proper English term. Because if you do something that cannot be described in proper English, it's probably not proper.
But I would prefer not to
bring it back at all.
But I'd prefer not to redefine an ordinary English term in a way that it's not used ordinarily.
Also, some of these terms already exist in our literature, and if we mean the same thing, we should use the same term, right?
We already use this.
Talk about components and debt equity and bifurcation and other
components. Concepts. I understand.
Componentization, we talk about, right?
Jesus.
Call it a neologism.
Derecognition.
What about derecognition, Hans?
Well,
no, let's not answer that question.
Shall we move? Yeah, let's move on to agenda paper 5D. So this paper discusses the application of the gamma approach to liability equity type exchange contracts. So these contracts, if exercised, will result in the entity receiving, extinguishing, redeeming liability in exchange for delivering equity, or vice versa, so receiving, extinguishing, redeeming equity in exchange for delivering a liability. So this contrasts to asset equity exchanges, where the entity receives both an asset and issues equity when the contract is settled. So in these contracts, because the item being redeemed or extinguished as part of settling the contract, because the item is by definition already on the entity's balance sheet, this brings an additional kind of issue to the to the classification question. So there are two questions in this paper, and we've separated them out. One has to do with the underlying rationale of what we're calling the redemption obligation requirement, which is an existing requirement in IS 32. The follow-on question is, if you agree with having something similar under the gamma approach, whether it would be desirable to be consistent across all the requirements for redemption obligation, fixed for fixed, and the compound instruments. Our first step in agenda paper 5D is we undertake a similar analysis to 5C for the asset equity exchanges, but we apply it to options that redeem an existing liability for issuing equity. So these are in paragraph 17 to 27. So for example, simple conversion options. And quite similar to asset equity exchanges, the conclusions are quite similar. So again, we look at whether the contracts require the entity to transfer resources, and we look at whether the contract is in its entirety dependent on the residual or is has some bit of variability. However, when we look at, again, this was just simply applied to contracts that redeem a liability for issuing equity. However, when we look at the opposite type of contract, when we look at contracts to redeem equity in exchange for issuing liabilities, we find that similar outcomes can be achieved within a variety of arrangements because of these types of contracts. All that's different is the form of the arrangement. So we'll illustrate this using some examples in paragraphs 28 to 57. Now, in our view, we think that a requirement similar to the existing redemption obligation requirement in 32 is needed to ensure that similar obligations are accounted for in similar ways. We also think that the gamma approach combined with some of the separate presentation requirements would help answer some of the challenges that we've identified. These would include the conceptual rationale for the redemption obligation and the separate presentation of, for instance, changes in the measurement of the fair value puts. So we think those combined would help address some of those challenges. I'll turn it over to the board first because I think the second question follows on from the first one. So the first question is whether you agree with our analysis that we probably need a redemption obligation requirement similar to IAS 32 to achieve the similar accounting outcomes for the gamma approach. For similar economic outcomes, so. Any questions?
We agree.
Does the board agree? Okay. All in favor?
No.
Yes.
All in favor. Steve?
I was going to ask a question. So I asked you this the other day. I've got shares in issue and I've got a contract to buy back those shares. And you're saying that it's different because we already have the instrument, the shares in issue, and effectively the forward transforms this into a liability. So in effect, we're combining the two things. But I'm not quite sure what makes it special in this case to do that combination rather than account for what we have, which is shares and a forward. Because if in sort of financial instrument land, I have a fixed rate bond and I have a swap to convert that into a variable rate bond, we don't combine the two and say, in substance, I have a variable rate bond. It's still a fixed rate bond and a derivative. So what's special in this case to change the account?
So I think that the special part comes from what we're trying to achieve with the gamma approach. And the problem is, if you look at the arrangement in its entirety, the net effect is that the entity has an obligation to transfer cash, and for the ones that we've illustrated here, it's a fixed amount, and so it meets both of the features of the gamma approach. In effect, what the entity has done is issued a bond to pay cash. However, and that's because the redemption of the shares negates the shares that are already on issue. So it's as if it's extinguishing those. It's almost like a share and sale and repurchase. So the entity sold the shares. However, it's entered into a contract to repurchase those shares for an amount that meets the definition of a liability. So that's also perhaps a useful analogy. It's because we want to also. It's also because we want to capture the liabilities first, and equity is the residual. So we need, the first step is always to identify the liabilities and then look at what the residual is. And this comes about because we're looking at the contracts as a whole. If we were to componentize, to use that term, this would be a liability, and the two the equity leg will cancel the existing shares on issue,
but
and you'd get a net.
That's my problem, because to get there, you have to componentize. So if you do componentize the forward,
yeah.
then I can see that the equity bits cancel, and all I'm left with is a liability. But then we decided earlier that we weren't going to componentize.
That's right, yeah.
So that kind of eliminates that line of thinking.
So, well, it doesn't eliminate it. I think the problem with classifying derivatives in their entirety is that some of these issues crop up. And so because we have decided to componentize, because we're classifying liabilities in their entirety, this issue crops up, and we need to have some additional requirements to ensure that we get some consistent outcomes regardless of how the arrangements are, how the arrangement is structured.
Yes, sir.
I don't look at it as being separating the derivative. I look at it as aggregating the equity instrument with the derivative. So I see it as an aggregate rather than a disaggregation. So I don't see it as being inconsistent. And you're right, it's sort of in the same way I always think of IAS 32 as being quite conservative. I think the gamma approach is quite conservative as well. It's almost as though you have to go down every path to prove it isn't a liability before you can ever get to equity. And because this equity might go away, that's a red flag under gamma in the same way that it's a red flag under IAS 32. So it's sort of a conservative model in that sense, I think.
And just on the sort of the, again, on the componentization point, I keep using that term. Sorry. We do, this comes back to compound instruments. Okay, so when we were looking at asset equity, we said we're not going to pull the standalone derivative out into components. However, if we have a convertible bond, we do bifurcate the convertible bond. So we look at the arrangement, we say that, okay, this is the liability component and this is the equity component. And so what we're doing here is we're saying, okay, if that arrangement, if those similar economic outcomes were arranged in a different set of contracts, we'd still want to have that liability component and that same equity component. And because the economic outcomes are the same, we'd want to account for them in the same way.
I don't disagree with the treatment of the forwards. I think it's logical and effectively you have a liability. What I've always struggled with, though, is having the identical treatment for a put, where I understand the conservative nature that the equity might go away and therefore it'd be wrong to show the equity and we'll show it as a liability instead. But a put is very different from a forward, and I'm not sure that difference really comes out by just ignoring the option effectively and saying, well, if the thing is,
yeah, well, I don't think we're I don't think we're ignoring the option. Similar to a convertible bond,
yep.
which has optionality that's controlled by the holder, we still account for what the entity, the liability component, in a way that, okay, the entity has no right to avoid paying this amount, and if it's for a fixed amount, it's for cash. Essentially, the entity has given the holder the right to call on it for liquidity purposes. It could call on it as a floor for the value of the share. What the option represents is some potential upside. Okay, and so if it's favorable to the holder, they might exercise the option to convert. With the written put, the option is the other way around, and so instead of exercising, they may not exercise the put if it's favorable to continue holding the shares. But the outcomes are still controlled by the holder, and they work out in the same way.
Yeah. I'm not disagreeing with the outcome, but I am bothered by the same point as Steve, really. I don't think we can say the underlying share has been extinguished by issuing the put. I mean, it might be a freestanding put that's issued to whoever buys it in the market, but all the underlying shares still exist. So I don't think we can say the claim in the existing shares has been cancelled by issuing a freestanding
no,
put.
I don't think we're saying that. And I think in the next section, what we go on to say is that we want to achieve some kind of we need to go beyond IAS 32, I think, and improve some of the requirements to make it more consistent and more complete. because some of the issues arising in practice relates completely to this point about what happens to the equity, because there's a IS 32 is silent. It's not clear whether implicitly we are extinguishing. I don't think we should be extinguishing the equity. I think there's probably some component of equity that represents the entity's obligation to the holder's right to continue holding the equity if they choose to do so. But the liability component still puts almost like a guarantee for the value of that share that we need to capture through the liability classification. The extinguishment point is only on settlement of the contract. Okay, it's not before.
Treasury shares are repurchased, so they disappear from the equity, but they still exist. They have not been cancelled yet until the time the company does actually cancel.
So it's a credit to cash and debit to equity, treasury shares, but they still are in existence.
Mary?
I guess I wasn't troubled in the same way that Peter and Steve were, because I was reading this, and maybe I was misreading, which I think is what I put my flag up to ask, saying, if we've got one of these written puts, I thought the first part of the analysis here was saying, because Gamma is trying to show two things, claims that are independent of the residual, or, you know, demands for cash, you know, yeah. Let me just say cash right now, cash before liquidation, that if you've written a put for X shares at a fixed price, you're just trying to show the gross amount of cash claim for that put, rather than recording the value of it.
Yes.
And so that seems to fit with Gamma, and I wasn't thinking through it as, are you artificially stitching together shares in issue with the written put? We're just saying one of the objectives of Gamma is to show the total amount of claims that can be made prior to liquidation, and since the put is written on a gross basis, it's saying that's why we record this at a gross amount. I thought that was all the really the first part of
that's
paper
the
paper was trying
part,
to say.
Yeah.
Okay, continue. I think we voted.
We voted.
We agreed with the first question.
Yeah. So the second part of the paper looks at in a little bit more depth the interaction between the requirements for derivatives on own equity. And so it tries to tie a lot of these discussions that we've had together. So in 5C, so the previous paper, we said that standalone derivatives that exchange asset and equity that are only fixed for fixed could be equity. In this paper, we've said that liability equity conversion can also be, conversion options can also be equity, only if it meets fixed for fixed. And we've also just said that we need something similar to the redemption obligation requirements to ensure we get similar accounting outcomes for similar economic outcomes. So, however, now in the existing 32, and I just mentioned this, the redemption obligation requirement sort of sits there in isolation, and it doesn't have too much detail about how to deal with the residual equity once you do the accounting, once you do the gross up for the present value of the redemption amount. This does give rise to problems in practice because it's unclear how to account for the rest of the arrangement, whether we are in substance extinguishing those equity, the ordinary shares underlying the put, or whether they continue to exist and we recognize something else within equity. What we would like to do is ensure that the redemption obligation requirement does not give rise to inconsistent accounting for similar arrangements. And so what we use as an example in paragraph 62 to 66 foreign currency convertible bonds and foreign currency written puts. And so in our view, we think that it would be desirable to ensure that similar obligations and arrangements are accounted for in a similar way, And so this would include consistency with the fix-for-fix requirement as well. We don't think that you should get a different outcome for the foreign currency convertible, which would, given what we've discussed so far, be accounted for as a liability in its entirety, and then get a different outcome for the redemption obligation simply because the arrangement is different. So we would like to reconcile those requirements to tie them all into a neat package. I do have the illustrate the example in table six, and that's just illustrating if we just have the redemption obligation requirement as it is under IAS 32 today, what the outcome might be under the gamma approach. And if we were to make it consistent, what we set out in paragraph 76, we set out that you would classify the obligation in its, including the hypothetical conversion option in the written put, you'd classify all that as a liability, and then you'd use IFRS 9 to do the recognition and measurement of the component parts, which would be the same as the FX convertible. I'll turn it over to the board for any questions before we ask for your
thoughts rather than questions. I agree with the logic of where you've got, and I think it's a good idea to try and align them. Having said that, I think it's a really big change in mindset for people who are used to IAS 32. It wasn't intuitive to me to get to paragraph 76. I had to sit and think about it for a while. And I understand how you got there, but I think at the moment, if you've got foreign currency denominated puts, you think about that very much just as being like a foreign currency liability, and you don't really think about the equity bit of it. Yeah. So to impute this, I understand where you're coming from, and I can see the similarity with the other case, but I think it is a big change in mindset. So we'd need to explain to people, I think, how the mechanics would work, because I don't think it's going to be terribly intuitive. And in terms of the measurement in paragraph 76, would this work similarly to how the interaction, are you thinking that this would work similarly to how the interaction between 32 and FI works today? So
yeah.
You'd measure the A and B fair value and work out the equity residual relative to the consideration, and then go to FI land and measure the embedded derivative B directly, and then the residuals, the liability.
Yeah.
It's going to be quite tricky for people, and it's quite artificial, so I think we're going to have to hum a few bars on that.
We will have to give the examples out here. It is not, because we are bringing out the optional feature, so that
sort
it's
of deeming things
deeming
that don't
things, yes.
Aren't explicit in the contract.
That's right. Oh.
But I agree with your logic.
And just maybe complimentary to Sue, and just to reconfirm with staff, I do agree with Sue, it's a different way of thinking of this, but just to confirm with staff, the gamma approach as you are applying here is actually changing this in a way, in a positive way, in a way that similar economics will be presented similarly, right? So
that's the goal, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This is the objective. So that's why this has this change of mind. And then that said, I also agree with Sue, it's important to be very, very clear on this and the benefits and advantages of the gamma approach over what is presently applied today.
Talking about it being an improvement, that's
yeah.
obviously in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, of
because
course.
Some people are going to have volatility they wouldn't have had otherwise.
Yeah,
no, but then,
yeah.
yeah.
Which is consistent
yeah.
with gamma, but
exactly,
we're going to have
yeah.
to explain that
yeah. Yeah.
why we think it's appropriate.
Okay, can we agree with a question? Speak to you.
All in.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Let's reconvene at 10 to 11.